Welcome to the Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners and murder cases from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's episode 71.
Woo!
Woo! Woo! Woo! It was anticlimactic, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was, yeah.
What are we doing with our lives, Nick? We're excited by numbers every week. How are you, Nick? How is Nick?
I feel weird.
Do you want to explain to the dear listeners why?
Well, for a good reason. I had my second jab yesterday, so I'm now fully jabbed. I can lick everything in sight.
Woo-hoo!
And everyone. But it's made me feel a bit weird.
You've got a bit weird with it.
I have got a bit weird with it.
Now, I had my second jab last week. I had no side effects, but I have been tired for about a week.
And even though I'm feeling weird, Sinead has still, at gunpoint, forced me to write a podcast episode and come up with a cocktail and said, no, you're fucking doing it, whether you like it or not. Here I am, suffering horribly.
We'll just eliminate the whole thing where I say, would you like me to do, like, help out or anything like that?
No, yeah, that never happened.
And yes, me at gunpoint, because this podcast exists just between the two of us in our heads. Well, dear listeners, you know how Nick feels about the situation. Any poisonings this week, apart from yourself?
Myself, with all the jabbertiness.
But good poison.
Well, no, absolutely. I can't argue with that.
Medicinal
poisonings. It's the way forward.
I think this medicine malarkey will catch on.
Absolutely. Sometime someone will do something with it.
You have lost your
mind. I have no idea what's going on.
Well, speaking of medicinal poisonings and losing your mind, I think it's time for us to thank our very, very sexy Patreon subscribers.
Who have also lost their mind in excitement about being Patreon subscribers. So I have no idea what's going on.
This bodes well. This is going to possibly be either the weirdest or the greatest episode we've ever recorded.
Shut up. Thank you so much to Megan Vining.
To Christian Richards.
And to Kelsey Perry. Darling people.
Thank you. You're very, very beautiful. You're very, very sexy. We love you. We also have a couple of special shout-outs this week. Now, we love to do a shout-out. If you ever want one, just drop us a DM. Within reason, don't ask us to do anything weird. Well, actually, you know what? Give it a go. All we'll do is block
do
you.
A lot of weird stuff.
Well, actually, yeah. So our first shout-out is to Andrew Burke, dear, darling listener, and Chelsea Schiffer from Ohio, who are getting married on the 17th of July. By the time they're listening to us, they may be husband and wife. They may be listening while trying to calm their nerves before the wedding.
Or as potentially as walking down the aisle to the poisonous cabinet.
Should we send them the theme music and she could
no,
then
I didn't
walk
think
down
voices.
The aisle?
just an episode entertaining the congregation as they go.
Okay, Nick, in a really weird voice, let's do the wedding march music. Come on.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Well, good luck on your wedding day with us behind you. Congratulations on your marriage. Enjoy your honeymoon in Mexico. And please do, as you promised, drink all the mezcal while you are there. Second shout out from one of our gorgeous Patreon subscribers, Chris Ollinger. Chris does amazing charitable work, and we wanted to give his organisation a little bit of a shout out this week. He started the Gwen Fund. The Gwen Fund is a non-profit animal welfare organisation based in Atlanta, in Georgia, and they're focused on providing financial assistance for critical veterinary care, palliative care and after-death care. The reason they started out this fund is to make sure that no one who has a sick animal as a pet owner feels that they have to resort to premature euthanasia rather than letting their pets be in pain because they can't afford the veterinary bills. We all know that veterinary bills are really, really high. This whole fund is there to assist people so they never have to face that dilemma. Please check it out, thegwenfund.org. Find them on Facebook, find them on Instagram, on LinkedIn. We will share links to them on our social media. But really wonderful organisation that Chris set up because of his own experiences. So please do check them out. Well, Nick.
Hello.
Are you ready?
I don't know.
To drink cocktails and talk about poison?
Mm-mm.
Or we could drink poison and talk about cocktails.
That's a tempting option, I give you, to be honest with you.
I'm worried that you're going to mix up the vials in the kitchen and that is actually what we're going to end up doing.
Could well happen.
We could just end up drinking poison and talking about poison.
Yeah, you never know.
Well, should we go with the first one on principle?
Oh, that's as we normally do.
Okay, hooray, hooray, hooray. It's Nick's story this week, but we can't possibly have a story without a cocktail in hand. As you know, dear listeners, each week we pick a secret ingredient that is inspired by the tale that we tell that will flavour our cocktail of the week. Nick's story this week, his pick for the secret ingredient.
Yes.
Mm. So this week's secret ingredient is...
I must admit, I struggled with this one.
Did you?
This was a tricksy one this
week. Did you now?
We've gone for something. Could be interesting. And it is story related, which is what we always aim for.
That is the whole point.
Yeah,
yes.
Halfway through, I thought I'd just go, oh, I can make it orange. He had an orange once. And that would be the link. But I thought, no, I must uphold the values of the poisonous cabinet.
Orange will always be the backup. Yes, let's just say that. When we really get stuck, we go, he had an orange, and you'll know we're lying.
He saw one in a museum once, and therefore that's the ingredient.
When was this?
Oh, it's way back. Way back.
Can't wait for the orange episode now. But it's not an orange.
It's not an orange. We have gone with the mustard. Dash.
The mustache. If you've only got a mustache. Oh, I love that song. And a mustache. I like this. I like this as an ingredient because I like mustaches.
Okay.
Twirly, twirly goodness.
Twirly, twirly goodness.
Shout out to Ollie from History Emporium podcast. it is inspired by you. Is everything that we do is inspired by you, Ollie.
And your magnificent mustache.
Magnificent it is.
But this mustache is in fact inspired by the tale.
People were frightened.
I feel.
They were worried that hair would be part of the
and
drink.
And you may have noticed, my moustache is somewhat reduced today.
Is it? So I genuinely was looking like, has he bloody trimmed his moustache and is just out in his COVID vaccine haze, just put moustache trimmings in my drink?
It's a lovely garnish.
Just to laugh. No, no, no.
I haven't done that.
No. Oh, good,
what
good
banter
God.
We have.
Well, with moustache as the ingredient, what on earth have you come up with?
Well, I haven't actually used a moustache as an ingredient.
Did you put on a big fake moustache
while making it? If only I had. There was another option. I thought, oh, I get a moustache strainer. Have you seen those? You can get little strainers that you have over. You get them on julep glasses. So when you're in the deep south and you're sitting on your porch with your big fancy moustache, you put it over your cup to stop you getting bits of mint and things in your moustache. So I thought, oh, that'd be good, but I don't have any of those either.
Also, your gesture of your big moustache, you put your hands out way past your head.
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
How big are the moustaches in the deep south?
You just wait. So this week we've gone for a slightly simpler interpretation of the moustache.
Okay.
With a cocktail named.
Yes.
The Sharpie Moustache.
The what?
The Sharpie moustache.
The Sharpie moustache?
Where the Sharpie bit comes in, I've got no fucking idea.
Oh, is in like a Sharpie pen where you draw it?
Yes. Sharpie. That's what it's called. It's called the Sharpie moustache. If that is inspired by someone named Sharpie who made it or was inspired by it, I do not know. But that is the name of the cocktail we are having today.
Oh, it must be you use a Sharpie to draw a moustache on a poster or a picture somewhere.
This is a bit fancy, this one.
Oh, is it?
I'm not sure it'll have that sort of thing. I do not know.
Well, an interesting name. Well, I'm intrigued to try it. Mm. I think, without further ado, it is time for us to go into the poisonous cabinet kitchen and shake up a storm. So we'll see you in a minute.
I'll see you in a bit.
And we're back.
Hello.
So, Nick, a Sharpie moustache we have in front of us.
Yeah.
It's a curious one. It looks like... I'm going to tell you, it looks like a Coca-Cola drink.
It does. The quantities are a lot greater than I had anticipated from the recipe I followed. So there's a lot more in the glass. And I have an awful lot of ice in there.
Yes.
So I think it will benefit for some dilution.
Well, it's most definitely brown. Very, very dark brown.
Most definitely brown. I have a suspicion that you are going to absolutely hate it.
And why?
I have a suspicion that I might hate it also.
Oh, God. Oh, is this going to be a disaster?
I think it's going to be an interesting one.
Oh, the brown drink is going to let us down.
So, well, who knows? We'll find out.
All right. Okay. Well, yeah, it's a curious looking one. It's looking long and refreshing and browny. So I guess we dive into the Sharpie moustache.
Dive too much.
Oh, sip, little sipperoo.
A sippy one.
Okay. Well, let's have a taste. All right. Well, well, down the hatch. Merry Christmas. Okay.
I stand very much corrected, as always.
It's okay. I was worried that there was going to be some sort of assault on the senses there a little bit too much.
No,
but as did I.
I thought there would be, but it's actually a lot. Subtle than I thought it was going to be.
No, Nick is very, very pleasantly surprised. You had set yourself up for this to be a total failure.
I have. There's far too much ice in there.
Yes, there is too much ice in there. You're really enamored with this.
No, there's too much ice in
that.
I need to sort this out.
Oh, okay. He's getting up.
Can't stop me.
We're gonna pause while Nick has a breakdown. Okay, wavy lines. Okay, well, Nick has come back from storming out of the room to deal with the ice situation.
Yes, I was very unhappy with it.
You had a large glass and it was pretty full of ice with this cocktail over it. So now Nick has reduced the ice quantity. I'm gonna go in for my second sip here. Okay.
I like that. I'm surprised.
I don't think that's world, personally. It's not
the most exciting cocktail in the history of the world, but I certainly think it's pleasant.
It's certainly more your cup of tea than it is mine. Yes. But I don't object to it. I can't work out what's in it. There's a couple of guesses. It's red vermouth, isn't it?
Red vermouth. Yep.
There is something medicinal tasting in there.
Yeah.
Is it Jaeger?
It's not.
Is it not Jaeger?
It's not Jaeger. You are damn close, though, and you won't get it.
Benedictine.
Nope.
A small can of Taboo.
Damn, you found me out.
I really don't know what else is in there. I don't know what accounts for the brownness. So I think you need to talk us through it, because it's. I will say, whatever's in there, it's not a taste sensation when you start, to me. To me, it isn't. It's a little bit, there's something herbal in there. It's fine, but I cannot really work out what it is. Nick is in heaven right now.
Yeah. So, we have a base of, there's four things in it, all booze, all in equal quantities. So we have gin.
Oh, okay.
We have a gin in there. Yeah. We have a red vermouth, as you say.
Yeah.
We have rye.
Oh, a rye.
We've got rye in there.
Ah.
And then we have another thing. We have Amaro Averna.
Boogada boogada you too, sir. What?
So, Amaros are a type of Italian spirit. Basically, your Campari is an Amaro.
Oh.
Aperol, even things like Jaeger and Unicorn, it's that sort of bitter, herby thing. Mm. They come under this umbrella term of Amaros.
Oh.
That's what that. And then you have loads and loads and loads of different ones. Now, I must admit, this particular cocktail, the exact recipe calls for Amaro Maletti, which I do not have, and I was not going to go and spend 40 quid on a bottle for the one cocktail.
Yeah, fair enough.
But I did have an Amaro Averna in the cupboard, which I thought is very, very similar. Your Amaro sort of heading is much like sort of your whiskey. Mm. And there is beneath that, there are a lot of different things. So you have a lot of different flavours within the whiskey sort of category. And Amaro is much the same. So you've got things, from your Campari and Aperol things right the way through to Jaeger and lots of other bits and pieces in between.
Definitely bitter.
So it's bitter, herby,
aromatic.
Medicinal. Yeah. Even at a push, you would include like chartreuses and things like that, because it's that herbal bitteriness in that category as well.
No, I don't think you'd categorise pure evil in
there. And then I've also put a dash of orange bitters in there as well.
Oh, interesting.
It is very much that sort of the bitter after dinner sort of aperitif type drink. It's not one to start, let's go and have a party, let's have one of these.
It is not when someone walks through the door, you hand them that and they go, what are you doing to me? Did I ever do to you?
No, indeed. This is your late night digestive after a meal in front of the fire type.
Ooh, yeah.
Just before you go to bed type drink.
I can imagine that if you're quite full, then you're going to want to have something like this to cut through. For me, it is in that medicinal category. I either prefer them straight, and even then I'm kind of like, I'm not so sure about it. On this scale, on this end of the scale, Campari, fine, delicious, lovely in lots of things. But yeah, it does have those hints of Jaeger and the dreaded Unicum. To me, it's a little bit too medicinal herbal.
Spectrum.
But it's not bad. For some people would hate it.
Oh, God, yeah.
Others would really, really appreciate this when you're into your cocktails. It's the sort of thing I can imagine in years to come,
years
or something like
that,
when you're really full after a big meal, you'd be like, oh, that's exactly what I need right now. Something to cut through and make me feel like I'm drinking cough syrup. I don't know. You love it.
I do. I really enjoy it. No, it's growing on me. It really is.
It is doing everything that Nick wants and Nick needs right now.
Quite. Yeah. Well, you've got your gin and tonic as well, so you have that.
It's a shit name, though. A moustache on its own?
Yeah, the sharp. There must be a reason for the Sharpie portion of it.
I mean, I can't imagine that it's anything other than drawing a Sharpie moustache on someone. How old is
maybe.
This cocktail?
Oh, it's not that old.
No, there we go then. Sharpie moustache, that's an awful name for quite a sophisticated drink. You need to have a damn good palate to enjoy this, as Nick does. Let's just call it the moustache for us. Or, you know, in England, as we would say, the tash.
The tash.
The tash. That's better. Okay, well, with our moustaches twirled round our fingers.
Twirled, indeed.
With yours firmly in hand, you're running away with it down into a corner to sit by a fire somewhere. I'm left in the doorway kind of going, I guess this is okay. Oh my God, it's literally like a double date and you've been matched up with your perfect person and I've been left with the reject that they brought along.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. Okay.
Is it time for a story, Nick?
Yes.
Yay!
So, we're off.
Yay!
So this week's tale starts on the other side of the world.
Ooh.
Far, far away.
Ooh.
In the quiet Melbourne suburb of Windsor.
Ooh. Australia.
So we are Australia.
We are off to Australia.
Indeed, it is the 3rd of March, 1892.
Oh, nice. Jack the Ripper.
Yes. We're finished now. Bye. And police have just arrived at 57 Andrew Street, where they have been sent to investigate vile smell coming from the building. They find the building abandoned. A few old boxes and papers scattered around, but no signs of recent life. They follow the increasing odour into the dining room, and they find the powerful smell is coming from the fireplace.
No.
The officers crowbar up one of the large stones in the hearth, and beneath they find the decomposing body of a young woman embedded in the cement.
Ooh.
Fun times.
Ooh, so she's been in the very foundations of the
yes,
house.
Yes, she's been buried in the fireplace.
Fuck.
A post-mortem reveals that the woman's throat has been cut and that she's been dead for around 3 months.
Oh, God.
So, yes, in some ripe condition when it is discovered. Detective Sergeant Considine and Corsi are both assigned to the case and they begin checking out the cottage's previous tenants. It is a man named Druin. And speaking to the locals in the area, they find an ironmonger who had sold Druin some cement and a broom and a trowel and a spade only a few weeks earlier.
It's a very well-stocked ironmonger.
He has all the things. He has all the things you need. It's your one-stop shop for all your burying people needs.
He raised no concerns as his man went up and listed these things out. And he's like, okay.
Well, your first thing is that this man is doing some building work.
No,
man is going to bury someone under his fireplace.
You know what? In 1892, maybe. In this day and age, we all know if anyone asks for those things. If this podcast has taught you nothing, people suspect the people asking for shovels and cement.
Yes, especially if they're going to their local ironmonger for it.
Pretty much, yeah. And if they're twirling a moustache.
So the ironmonger describes Druin as being in his mid-30s, fair-haired, with a reddish beard and a large, distinctive moustache.
Is that it?
Oh, you just wait.
Ooh, okay.
He was of medium height and slight build. The ironmonger also reported that Druin was incredibly flamboyant in his manner, dressed with an awful lot of jewellery, and spoke loudly and confidently with an English accent. In the house, the detectives find a torn luggage ticket as one of the scraps of paper that had been left lying around, and they trace it back, and they find that Mr. Druin has arrived in Melbourne from the UK a few months earlier on the ship, the Kaiser Wilhelm II, accompanied by his young wife. Time they had been travelling under the name Albert and Emily Williams. The detectives question other passengers from the ship, and they have no trouble whatsoever remembering Mr. Williams.
sounds like they wouldn't.
He had been loud, boastful. He had bored anyone he could with his obviously fictional tales of his travels all over the world and his adventures. He repeatedly offends the ship's crew by accusing them of stealing he and his wife's valuables, going into their cabin and stealing their things. And everyone is incredibly pleased to see the back of Mr. Williams.
There's always one on holiday.
Absolutely, yeah. It's like on a cruise. It's like, just fuck off, you're really annoying. Not that I've been on a cruise, but I imagine that's the way.
Yeah. I imagine a cruise is awful.
Yeah, I've got it.
Yeah.
The police unsurprisingly suspect that the woman beneath the fireplace is the wife, Emily. The two detectives issue a nationwide alert for Albert Williams, and a description for Williams, or aka Druin, is sent to every police station in Australia. It doesn't take too long before a man matching Williams' description is reported. He had been seen boarding a ship that had sailed on the 23rd of January from Melbourne to Perth. The flamboyant Mr. Williams had been noted by his outrageous and excessive behaviour.
Well, I was going to say that, I mean, when they say, let's look for this incredibly flamboyant, jewel-covered man strutting around, twirling a cane and his moustache at the same time, you'd probably notice.
Yes, yeah, indeed. And this time, he is travelling under the name of Baron Swanston.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yes, the Baron.
He's up to the level. He is now a Baron.
Fuck it, why not?
Well, why the hell not? Absolutely. Police immediately issued a wanted poster to every town, city and settlement in Western Australia.
Love a wanted poster.
Trying to find Baron Swanston. And it turns out he's not that hard to locate, really. His very boisterous nature, his fancy jewellery that has never come off, his city clothes, his large, distinctive moustache, and his English accent stand out a mile away.
Is he the sort of person who's just leaving a trail of jewels in his way?
Pretty much. He makes sure everyone knows he's there and he's been there. He wants to be the centre of attention. He's the least subtle man I've ever heard about.
And is he? How big is the moustache?
You look at pictures, it's actually not that, it's not that big. I mean, it's a decent size. It does come out considerable.
It does, twirly edges. He's
very long and spiky.
Oh, okay.
So it is distinctive. The day after Emily is buried in Melbourne, a trooper wires the Melbourne detectives to report that Baron Swanston has been found in the small mining settlement of Southern Cross, in the remote goldfields of Western Australia. The Baron has taken a job as an engineer at the Fraser Gold Mine, but he'd been found and he is now safely under lock and key, awaiting instruction from the detectives.
Well, he took a job as an engineer?
He's gone out there, he's bluffed his way into a job, probably quite a relatively well-paid job as one of the engineers on the gold mine.
Office job.
Or looking after the machinery, overseeing many people. Who
turning up in his resplendent outfit and jewels with a token hard hat on, going, I shall look after all the machines.
I think hard hats were not a thing at this point.
He'd fashioned one out of diamonds.
But now he has been imprisoned, he has now been locked away. News of the arrest of Durin / William / Swanston quickly makes its way across Australia. Papers declare Windsor murder arrested. Back in Melbourne, the detectives Considine and Corsi have been continuing their investigations as well into their suspect, and they've discovered yet another name. They know this time it is not an alias. They have identified the real man, and the name is Frederick Bailey Deeming.
Ooh, it means nothing. Deeming sounds seeming.
I've never heard of that.
Deeming, he sounds evil.
Deeming, they discover, had arrived from England in 1881 with his wife Marie and a young family.
Oh.
He operated a gas fitting shop in Sydney until the store mysteriously burnt down.
In my brain, my stupid brain was kind of, how do you fit gas?
the fixtures for the lighting and the pipes and the switches and the valves and things.
Yes, he didn't just have a shop full of gas.
He doesn't have, just like selling bags of gas, basically. Here, come and buy your gas. Five pence a bag of gas.
And it's shocking that place burnt down.
Well, he's not storing the gas on the property.
Exactly.
He hasn't got bags of gas, boxes of gas.
Ushering it into a hat box and then handing it over.
I may not really know how things work.
I have no idea how things work. That thought sincerely inhabited me there for a minute.
Right. So you regularly get your gas delivery for your hob at home and things. Right, moving on. People who remember Deeming described how it was an open secret, and everyone knew that Deeming had burnt down the store himself for the insurance money. It turns out that he'd even been imprisoned for a few weeks for theft from a previous employer.
Oh.
So he's obviously not a very trustworthy chap. They also remember how Deeming was quite the expert at drawing attention to himself. He did like the attention. Neighbours and friends also remembered his wife, Marie. And she is nothing at all like the description of Emily Williams found at the house in Melbourne. She is different in every way. She's older, shorter, a darker complexion. And it's looking like there had been two Mrs. Deemings. But where was the original one? And what of the children?
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Well,
they went away to a farm and lived happily ever after.
They lived happily ever after.
Oh, God. Oh, okay.
With Deeming still locked up in Southern Cross, where he'd been posing as an engineer, he was waiting for transport to Melbourne to face a murder charge. The detectives set about trying to find the missing Mrs. Deeming and the children. Again, the only lead they find is, again, a crumpled up bit of paper in the house in Melbourne. It is an invitation to a dinner party.
Oh, lovely.
Which is very fancy, held at the Commercial Hotel, Rainhill. In England.
Oh.
The soiree had been held by Mr. Albert Williams.
Oh.
It turns out that Albert Williams might have existed after all. Was he, in fact, a real chap whose name had been usurped by this other man? Or had he held this fancy party in Rainhill?
Did he go to there? Does he have the invite and that's where we got the name from? Ooh,
detectives
okay.
are asking exactly the same questions.
Yeah.
What's going on?
They telegraph
the Lancashire police. Going, can you have a look into this? Can you try and track down this Mr. Williams and see if he can shed any light on this missing wife and the family? The police inquiries in Lancashire lead them to a Rainhill news agents, which was run by a Mrs. Mather. The officers ask her if she knows Albert Williams, where they can find Albert Williams. I do, she says. I do know Albert Williams. Weren't expecting that one, were you?
I wasn't expecting
Neither was
that
I.
One. I was wondering, are you going to do the accent?
No.
You're just going to go with that. A woman who was just surprised yes, by everything.
Surprised woman.
I do from Lancashire.
Turns out he was her son-in-law.
No.
Yeah, dude. But he's not here. He's on honeymoon in Australia with his lovely new wife.
Oh, bloody hell.
She says, my daughter, he married my daughter. She's off on honeymoon. Detectives quickly realise that the body found in the Melbourne house is Emily Mathers, the woman's daughter.
Oh, no. Oh, bloody hell. Oh, mind blown.
It's a very convoluted plot of many names and confusions.
I'm literally grabbing my head at the moment. So he's travelled over with a woman and two kids. We don't know where they are.
Yep.
But now it transpires that the woman who was under the fireplace.
Yeah.
Is the daughter of this poor lady
the
in
poor
Lancashire.
Poor lady in Lancashire, absolutely.
Who's saying, oh, they were on honeymoon.
They were on honeymoon, so recently married.
What? And how? Well, how the hell did she get over there with the other women? I know we've got a gap of... What?
Hopefully all will become clear.
Okay, I'm going to keep drinking this cocktail.
This is wise.
This is the thing. Like, I'm 100% behind you here, Nick, but there's a tiny part in the back of my head is going, is this a fever dream?
Potentially.
That you have made up because of the vaccine.
Yep,
it's
yep.
brilliant if it is.
It could make no sense.
Edge of my seat. Everyone's going to write, I have questions.
What's going on here? Mrs. Mathers describes how Albert Williams... or the man she knew was Albert Williams, had arrived in Rainhill in October 1891. He rented a house named Deanham Villa on the outskirts of the village, supposedly for his employer, Colonel Brooks, who was due back on furlough from his service in India.
What? Okay.
While waiting for the colonel to arrive, Williams lived at the local commercial hotel,
okay.
where the invitation for the fancy party was
oh,
from.
Right. I'm with you. The colonel came. The colonel.
And he made himself incredibly popular at the hotel. He was holding court in the bar every night,
right.
being very extravagant with his generosity, buying drinks, spinning tales of his global adventures. I mean, of course, the colonel does not exist and he never turns up.
Oh, okay.
Because a man such as Albert Williams, he would not have probably got such a fancy villa because he probably came across as a lowly working class man sort of thing.
Yes.
This is a fancy villa for a fancy person.
He's renting it for someone else.
I'm renting it for my employer.
Colonel Brooks, who was a relative of Colonel Mustard.
So
he's using his name to live the high life at
Absolutely.
The hotel.
Yes, he's in the hotel. The colonel will pay for all this drinks. The colonel will pay for it when he comes and takes the villa.
Clever.
And everyone buys it. Everyone goes with it.
Well, yeah.
Emily Mathers certainly does. The young woman falls for him instantly.
No.
His gregarious ways, his storytelling, his larger-than-life personality, and they are married on the 22nd of September, 1891. Williams, he throws a lavish reception at the commercial hotel before departing on honeymoon aboard the Kaiser Wilhelm II.
Oh, no. Oh, she believed his flamboyant ways.
She's going to have an exciting... Going to Australia on a honeymoon. Even now, that's something exciting and grand. For the time.
Being a criminal, that's amazing going over.
Going halfway across the world for this little young woman from a Lancashire village. Honeymoon in Australia.
Yeah.
That is the most exciting thing that's ever going to happen to you in your
Absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely. And he's like covered in diamonds and loveliness and everything. Yeah,
gotcha.
Fuck boy.
But the detectives have still found no sign of the original Mrs. Deeming and the children.
No.
That they were originally
Where
set
are they?
Out.
Where are they?
Where the hell are they? Now, Mrs. Mathers, the mother, certainly didn't know of a previous wife. As far as she was aware, he wasn't a widow or anything like that. But then she remembers something. There had been talk amongst the locals of a woman and children living at Deanham Villa. She was sure that she had heard that it was William's sister and her children who had been visiting for a bit of a holiday before the colonel turned up. But they hadn't been seen for an awful long time. And it just assumed that they had gone home to wherever it is they came from.
Oh.
A neighbour also remembered talking to a young boy and a girl one afternoon after they had asked if they could have some strawberries from his garden.
Strawberries, Nick. Strawberries.
Yep, I didn't get that one. My crazy fever dream. I entirely missed strawberries.
It was right there.
Ah, shut up.
We could have had strawberries.
Start it all again. Start over. Do it again. Shut up.
It's okay. Strawberries are quite common. They'll probably come up again.
Yeah, well, indeed. Fuck. Before the neighbour can say anything, the pair are called inside by a woman from the house, who then abruptly closes the door and draws all the curtains. There have been other briefs...
Not suspicious at all.
Not in the slightest bit suspicious. There have been other brief sightings of the woman and her children by other neighbours, but now they are nowhere to be found. They haven't been seen for ages. Mm. So the assumption is They've gone home to wherever it is they came from. End of story. Nothing weird there.
Yeah, you wouldn't really question that because if the help is maybe let their family stay there for a little bit.
Absolutely.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. And they sister, shouldn't be there when the colonel arrives.
Well, exactly. The sister and the nephews, they come to get away from the city, have a bit of time in the nice little countryside, and then they're off again. No harm done.
Totally. It's like living in a house if you're an estate agent until it's sold. That doesn't happen.
Okay.
I mean, if you were selling a mansion, you totally would. I would.
You would.
Hence why I'm not an estate agent.
Probably wise. Probably wise. Don't let Sinead sell your house. A police visit Dynam Villa. There's no answer. They break in to see what leads they can find.
Okay. Excessive.
Well, they know something's going on here. No, William.
They ring the bell once.
There's no answer from the house. The colonel is obviously not there.
One of the constables is really excited and has an axe.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we could just open the door. It's not locked. No, we must break in.
We must break it in. They break in to see what they can find, and they are confronted by the most terrible, terrible smell.
No. Oh, God, no.
They trace the smell to the fireplace.
Again?
And just like in Melbourne, when the police pull the fireplace apart with crowbars and shovels, they uncover human remains.
No.
This time it is a woman and two children.
No.
All in a very advanced stage of decomposition. The corpses are wrapped with oilcloth, with the woman upon her back, and two children are turned with their faces towards her, lying on one on either side.
Oh, God, that's grim.
With further investigation, they find another two children embedded in the cement below the woman's feet.
What?
The woman and a nine-year-old girl have been strangled. The other three infants have had their throats cut.
Oh, my God.
Police find a book in the burial with a name Deeming. It had been crossed out and replaced with Williams. Police are left with little doubt that Deeming or Williams are in fact the same person.
That's horrific.
It's a terrible,
that's
terrible thing.
Chilling. I do need to pick up on one thing.
Yes.
You've committed an horrific crime. Poor woman and those poor children that you've buried in the cement under the fireplace. You just put the book
there. Why would
there
you leave the book? I know.
With your name crossed out and another one written there. You were by a fireplace, mate. You were by a fireplace. What is going on there?
Huge overconfidence he has. These things are never going to be found. It's never going to come up. It's never going to affect me again. I'm now off to the other side of the world. This is never going to come back to me.
You don't bury a body with the assumption that it's going to be found.
No, well, indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed not. So he's just chucked this in
I'm
there.
I'm told. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was a very... You just don't.
So, no, you don't. You don't, mate. Have I ever been accused of anything? No, obviously not.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, if you're gonna murder children and their mother and then just bury them like that, yes, you would have that level of arrogance.
Completely.
Who cares? Here's my new alias. And he's not a subtle man. As
he is not a subtle man. Absolutely not. Absolutely
not. Oh, I don't like it.
An inquest is held. Over the deaths, and two men come forward and identify the woman as Marie James, that she and the children were the family of their older brother, Frederick Deeming. They explain to the police that their brother Frederick had married Marie James in 1881. The two girls, Bertha and Mary, were born in Sydney.
Okay.
And in the mid-1880s, the family spent some time in South Africa, and their third child, a boy named Sydney, was born at sea. They had returned to England in 1890 and had their fourth child, the infant girl, Layla. And after a brief stay with the brothers, Deeming and his family then disappeared, apparently to Rainhill, where Deeming had taken on Dynam Villa and kept his family hidden away while he merrily played the eligible bachelor about town.
Whoa, okay.
Happy with all there's a lot of dates going on there.
That's fine. I trust you. 100% it's probably right. I think from Sydney, and that's right, and that, but okay, so yes, has a wife and these four children.
Four children. Goes to Australia where he's running his gas shop in Sydney.
Yes, yes.
Comes back to the UK via South Africa, where there are actually reports he's involved in a few sort of diamond frauds things, but
to make a hat.
He ends up back in the UK.
Right.
Stays with his brothers for a bit, has their fourth child, and then moves to Rainhill, where he's got Dynam Villa, and has unfortunately killed his family.
But then what's happened? What's happened? Why? What has led to their deaths in this house?
Well, police, they reason that as soon as he meets Emily Mathers in the village, at the local pub, he falls madly in love or something. Obviously, he's got a wife and family hidden away in the villa.
Yeah.
He thinks, no, I want to be with this younger, more attractive lovely young girl. No. I want to marry her and run away back to Australia with her. What's the best way of doing that? Let's kill the family.
Kill your entire family?
Kill the entire family, hide their bodies in the fireplace. I can then remarry Emily Mathers and start my life all over again.
Okay.
The discovery of these five bodies is on March the 16th, 1892. It was only 2 weeks after the body of Emily had been discovered in the identical circumstances in the house in Melbourne. Frederick Deeming, when he was found, had an awful lot of explaining to do.
I don't think the police said that. No. Rocked up with their hands on him. You've been learning explaining to do, Mr. Deeming.
Absolutely. Deeming, who at this point is in jail in the Southern Cross, is now taken by three armed constables for a 5-day train trip to Perth.
Okay.
The train stops in various towns, and each time a crowd has gathered to greet the man who is now being publicised, who has slaughtered his entire family and his second wife. And he is handcuffed throughout the trip, and a strict watch is kept to make sure he doesn't try and escape, or that no one gets in, because these people are not happy. When the train eventually arrives at Perth, the crowd is so large at the train station that instead of disembarking at Perth Central, Deeming is taken off one stop before and jumbled into a van and driven the rest of the way to avoid these crowds and the people who would just grab him. At the Perth courthouse, Deeming is put into the custody of Detective Causey, one of the chaps from Melbourne who was on his initial case. From Perth, they then begin the 250-mile overnight trip to Albany.
Right.
Where they will rendezvous with the SS Ballarat, which will take them on to Adelaide, and from there they will get the train to the final leg back to Melbourne. I do forget how fucking big Australia is sometimes.
Australia is huge. It's very, very big.
How terrifyingly large it is. Word passes down the line that this despised killer is going to pass through the local community soon.
Yes.
And at every stop, an increasingly angry crowd gathers. People shout for him to be dragged from the train, lynch him.
Mm.
There's one account that someone shouts that he should be tied to between two bullocks and then
torn apart.
Torn to pieces.
Whoa.
Such is the anger in
Fair
the
enough.
Air. The mob surge forward and surround the train, and the sheer mass of people is enough to rock the train carriage on the rails.
Wow.
There's a big old train carriage. There's many, many tons. So the amount, the anger and the people trying to get in. Fortunately, the doors hold and the crowds are kept at bay, and the train eventually carries on its way to Albany.
I mean, this is their local entertainment. It's not like...
Well, quite, there's not much else to do.
It's the equivalent of the premiere of Love Island each year, you know.
They eventually make it to Albany, where they board the ship, taking them to Adelaide. Throughout the entire journey, a trio of officers, including Detective Causey, keep an hourly watch on their prisoner to ensure that no harm should come to him, either by himself or by someone else breaking in to do him harm.
Good stuff.
However, in the morning, the three guards are astonished.
What?
To find that their prisoner is missing his most distinctive feature, his large moustache.
His moustache. What?
Is entirely gone. The loss of his moustache exposes a really wide, ugly mouth. It makes his large chin even more prominent. His guards agree that he has done an excellent job of removing his moustache in the middle of the night, considering he has no tools, he has no razor or anything like that to do it. In his clothes, they find a piece of a glass bottle, about the size of a coin, which he had used as a bit of a razor to do this.
Okay.
But for the most part, they find that he's actually plucked out each hair individually by the root of his moustache. What's more, he has done so in entire silence and without moving throughout the night, so no one had noticed that he was doing this.
Why?
The detective, Causey, is incredibly concerned about the missing moustache.
Yeah.
It made him look very, very different. The moustache was one of the key features that had identified him. It's what witnesses grabbed onto to identify him as the culprit or as him, the man they had seen. It's this big moustache. Without that, he looks like an entirely different person.
Yeah.
Could they really get witnesses to say, yeah, it's still him?
And his picture has been shared across Australia.
Yep.
All these people have been lining up looking for this
looking
guy
for
with
this
big
man
mysterious
with a big moustache.
With a big distinctive moustache.
Absolutely. Now there's nothing. He's entirely sort of clean shaven.
Planning something?
Well, I think he's planning just to put that bit of doubt in people. If a witness is called to the stand to say, is this the man you saw or is this the man you met 5-10 years ago in Sydney? And they go, well, that man had a big moustache. Are you sure it's this man? Can you be 100% sure that it's this man here?
Can you put a big moustache on him? Yeah. Bring in the big moustache.
Are you sure enough that if you get it wrong, he's going to die?
It's a good tactic. So
it's a cunning plan.
Yeah.
He knows it's a cunning plan. And as apparently a quiet, sarcastic smile breaks over his face when he notices that the detective going, oh, fuck. This is a big part of our case.
Yeah.
In Melbourne, he is formally charged with the murder of Emily Williams.
Mm.
When asked his name, he refuses to answer.
Mm-hmm.
So he is charged as Albert Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Not his real name, but that's the name he's gone by. So that's the name they will charge him on. The trial begins on the 2nd of May, 1892. The defence plead not guilty, unsurprisingly, on the grounds of insanity. Six independent doctors examine Deeming several times, but not one of them is willing to state that he is insane. That is thrown out the window.
Fair enough.
The trial lasts 4 days, and evidence is quite damning, really, despite the removal of the moustache. Doctors suggested that he suffers from epileptic fits. Potentially.
No.
He certainly has syphilis, which they are able to prove, which they think may have affected his mind slightly.
Okay, fair enough.
VD can affect your mind. He's been shagging around a lot. When he speaks, he drifts between sort of moody and sullen to excitable and garrulous, the character that he's known for. He fantasizes all about his past glories that are pretty much all in his head. On one occasion, Deeming claimed that his dead mother had told him to kill Emily Mather. But that is quickly dismissed as him trying to up the case for the insanity.
Right, yeah.
And they
go,
no, we don't believe a word of that one.
So yeah,
you're
exactly.
Just trying it on, mate. So, no, all in an Australian accent, obviously.
You're not doing the accent.
I'm not doing the accent. I know, I'm very, 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 very poor. One of his doctors, one of the doctors who had examined Deeming, reports that he had told him several times that he had gone out with a revolver searching for women who had given him venereal disease, given him VD, and he had intended to kill them to get his revenge.
What? Yeah, sure, why not?
Deeming, against the advice of his lawyers, decided to make his own closing statements, closing arguments.
Yes.
Starting his statement saying, I don't think there's ever been a man brought into court that has ever been more prejudged more than I have been. It does not endure him to the jury.
Everyone just sort of cracks their knuckles going, carry on, mate, carry on. You poor white privileged man.
He goes on picking up speed and his insatiable ego soon comes out. He begins to boast of all his conquests. It is not giving up life, I fear, not the slightest. I have gone through the world, the dangers I have faced, I am not afraid to give up my life. I have been on that Zambezi among the blackfellows, and have been battered about the head, and gone among bears, and gone into lions' caves, and brought them out alive. He says he's done all these amazing things. The jury are not entirely convinced by his outbursts. And he is sentenced to death for the murder of Emily Mathers.
Good. Because normally you don't use the defence of, I fought a lion
I
once,
fought a lion and I won. That's how great and amazing I am.
but you still killed people.
Well, he never stands trial for the murder of his wife or children in the UK.
No.
But
one
is
Emily
enough.
Mathers.
But he does for Emily Mathers.
Yeah, as we all
and
know.
And that's gonna get him. Frederick Deeming is executed on the 23rd of December, 1892.
Good.
Reports claim that he very casually walks towards the scaffold without a care in the world, puffing on a large cigar as he goes walking to the scaffold.
Okay, fair enough.
Oh, the story does not end there.
Oh.
Press across the world have picked up on this case, especially in the UK with the UK connection, where every aspect of Deeming's life is picked through for the entertainment of the masses. In London, one reporter picks out a tiny detail that was revealed by Deeming's doctors at the trial. The reporter fixates on how Deeming had said that he had gone out searching for women who he believed have given him syphilis, looking to kill them for revenge. This small comment is pulled apart, and when the reporter discovers that Deeming had been in the UK in 1888, there is only one possible conclusion to draw.
Shut up.
Frederick Deeming is Jack the Ripper.
No! No! I joked at the start.
You did.
I did. Oh my God.
I thought, no, she's found me out.
I had no idea. Of course he is Jack the Ripper. I mean, there's no other explanation.
No, absolutely not.
Jack the Ripper was resplendent in diamonds. He strutted about Whitechapel going, I've killed a hooker, hello. Oh my God. No. Yes, at the same time, yay for more Jack the Ripper suspects. Just bollocks. I bet you that got so much press.
Oh, absolutely. More so than the actual his actual crimes and stuff like that. It was another. It was Jack the Ripper is dead.
Jack the Ripper is dead. Yeah. Love it.
A story of Frederick Bailey Deeming.
You did it, Nick.
I did it.
Yay!
I survived. My God, that was rambly.
No, it was a really, really good story, Nick. I was 100% here for it. No, that got me, Nick. I didn't like that man. And the lies and the running across the world. And bloody hell. I mean, we've had some shits on this show. We've had some absolute bastards.
Yeah.
But let's not gloss over the fact that just because he's fancied a new woman,
he wants to shag someone else,
murdered his entire family.
Four kids
and his wife
and a newborn. Yeah.
Ugh. Oh God, no, he is a shit of the highest order.
Quite.
Bastardometer is off the chart right now. That's a good story though. That's so flamboyant.
I know, so that he was recognised wherever he went. People thought, I remember that chap.
Yeah.
I remember him because he's such a nutter.
I mean, that's crazy to think that. I mean, we say it's crazy now because we've covered so many murderers and we all know the murder cases about, like, try to hide your crimes. Don't strut about the place with a cane and jewels and the best dress ever and then shout at all the passengers on your ship on the way to Australia and make complaints. Don't make yourself visible. But clearly he didn't care.
He was just so confident in his own skills that he's never going to get caught, or, well, if they do, who the hell is going to believe them? Because I am. That's fantastic.
Chills me more to the bone maybe than other things, I suppose, to have that level of arrogance to do that to your family, to do that to children, to do that to a newborn and the way in which they died, and then to just not have a care, just to be no, this is perfectly acceptable and I'm going to be my flamboyant self. But why did he murder his other woman?
There were some reports that I read that by the time he had got to Southern Cross, to the mining settlement, he had proposed to another woman on the way, father had intervened and said, no, you're not good enough for my daughter, and that marriage, that engagement never stuck. But that was only in one or two of the reports, so I wasn't sure if that was accurate or just a...
That's the thing, is that thing. What happened? What about Emily? I mean, why did she end up under the fireplace?
Who knows? Just got bored?
I mean, he never obviously gave any explanation.
Never gave any explanation as to why. Just got bored. I want to go out and do new things.
That is a weird case then, I suppose, that to build that he had killed her, not having a motive at the trial, apart from maybe greed, but basing it on the fact that he probably did kill his wife and family in England, but he never stood trial for that.
Yes, absolutely. And there's some similarities between the two. Throat slit, under the hearth, in the fireplace.
Don't know what the law is in Australia. I don't know what the law would have been at the time. Certainly nowadays, and for many years has been, you can't have previous convictions used as evidence against you in a new court, but he wasn't ever convicted, so maybe that was the thing, that here's the character witnesses.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
That's hearsay, though, isn't it? It's bizarre. Oh, that's bizarre. That's a really interesting... I want to read more about this. I want to read more about this crazy, crazy flamboyant man.
Plenty out there.
Oh, the poor lady's under the fireplace. I don't like it, Nick. Good story. Rambly though it was. It wasn't, but it wasn't bad rambly, because you tied everything together beautifully. I felt looked after.
I jumped around with my dates a lot.
But obviously he was Jack the Ripper.
Well, obviously. I mean, it's the only possible explanation.
Only possible explanation. He came back to England, killed a load of women, went back to Australia, then came back, and then... Oh, my God. No. Well, what do you think, people? Do you know the story of... Well, what name are we going to use for him?
Well, I mean, Frederick Deeming.
Frederick Deeming.
Was his Deeming. Deeming. D-E-E-M.
Deeming.
Deeming. So that indeed was his real name. So I think we should go with his actual name.
So Frederick
than his alias.
Deeming.
But Baron Swanston.
Baron Swanston, also known as Albert Williams.
Albert Williams, yes, and Mr. Durin. Don't know the first name of Mr. Durin.
And Mr. Durin. All of these men, what do you think of the story? Do you know the story? Are you one of our Australian fans? Please, please, please message us and write in and say, whether you know it or not, just say, hi, I'm from Australia. We'll all give you likes and love. What were his motives? Was it just that he was that arrogant and after a bit of skirt? Just, what the hell? Just so thrown by this. What outfit would you wear if you wanted to evade capture but still look fabulous?
Well, that's the important bit.
Criminal but make it fashion. Mm. Send us your suggestions, send us your ideas and your thoughts, comment on any of the social media posts on this episode, DM us, share your own thoughts, and please share this story to all of your friends, your family, your enemies, your co-workers, people that you've seen once somewhere in the street. Yeah. Send it to them, just ping it to them on the app. And if you haven't already, come and join us on Patreon. Lots of extra episodes, an episode every week that you can enjoy on Patreon. Lots of bonus material, lots of frivolity and larks and japes and
all the
lovely
stuff.
Conversations on there. So do join us on Patreon if you haven't already. And send us more shout outs, more suggestions for stories, and just more musings about why Poison is just fabulous. Thanks for listening, guys. We have been the people inside the poisonous cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Bye.